Lecture 24, Three Scenarios for the Origin of Life.
We've come to the 24th and final lecture of this series on the origins of life. And I think you'll agree that we've covered a lot of territory, but it's also obvious that the scientific story is not even close to being over. As in so many arenas of scientific research, what we know today is dwarfed by what remains to be discovered. But we're at a stage where the problem is clearly defined. We know what we have to do, and literally hundreds of scientists are tackling the question full time. Lots of advances are being made, and there's no doubt that we'll see real progress in our lifetimes. Just during the time I've been delivering this course, new work has appeared from NASA's Cassini-Huygens and deep impact missions that reveal amazingly rich sources of organic molecules in water in our own solar system. I have three main objectives in this concluding lecture. First, I want to show you how the various debates and worlds that we've considered in previous lectures contribute to one or another of three broad scenarios for the origins of life. Second, I want to give you a sense of the vibrant state of research on what came just after the origins of life. An army of scientists around the world are trying to understand how life continued to develop after the emergence of the first living entity. There were lots of important chemical developments, to be sure. For example, the introduction of DNA and proteins, and the emergence of photosynthesis. And then there were billions of years of biological evolution from relatively simple single cells to all the complexity of multicellular plants and animals. Third, I also want to touch briefly on how NASA and other astrobiology groups are conducting the search for life on other worlds. One of the central objectives of astrobiology, beyond an understanding of origins on Earth, is the search for life on Mars, on Jupiter's moon Europa, on Saturn's moon Titan, and other nearby planets and moons. That's an effort that may reveal to us whether life is indeed a cosmic imperative, or if it's relatively rare in the universe. These stories are not necessarily part of the story of life's emergence on Earth, but they certainly play a major role in the broader field of astrobiology. So the time has finally come to summarize this lecture series. As I mentioned at the beginning of this course, the Santa Fe Institute theorist Stuart Kaufman wrote one of my favorite quotations regarding the origins of life. He did this in 1995, and he said this. He said, "Anyone who tells you that he or she knows how life started on Earth is either a fool or a knave." Now, Leslie Orgel, who played such a key role in the RNA world model, put an interesting twist on this idea. He said, "Anyone who thinks they know the solution to this problem is deluded. But anyone who thinks it is insoluble is also deluded." Well, I certainly haven't given you the answer to life's origins, nor could anyone else at this point in history. But I agree that the chemical and physical steps that led to the origins of life are knowable, and someday the story will be known. We've learned a tremendous amount, and the basic outlines of the origins process are coming into focus. In Lecture 3, we explored the tricky question, what is life? And while there's no absolutely correct answer, we did identify a few essential defining characteristics. For one thing, life is chemical in nature. That's why we focus so much attention on the kinds of chemical reactions that might have transformed simple, small, carbon-based molecules into larger, more complex molecular structures. Then life requires self-replication, so we need a molecule, or more likely, a cycle of many molecules that makes copies of itself. What's more, that self-replicating cycle has to display some degree of chemical variability. In that way, different versions of the system will compete for resources, and the entire chemical cycle will have the ability to evolve. Gradually, the entire chemical system will become more efficient at processing matter and energy. In addition, new variations of the system will become adapted to a variety of different environments, including a range of different temperatures, pressure, salinity, acidity, and other chemical factors. That much is pretty certain, but there's a lot we don't know about that first living system. Was it autotrophic, making its own molecules from water and volcanic gases? Or was it heterotrophic, scavenging amino acids, sugars, lipids, and other molecules from the surroundings? We also don't know if self-replication began as a metabolic cycle, like the reverse citric acid cycle, or as a genetic molecule similar to RNA. We're not even sure if the first life form was encapsulated in a primitive membrane like modern cells, or if it was a flat layer growing sideways on mineral surfaces. So what do we know for sure? Let's go back to the very first lectures when I introduced the top-down approach. We worked our way backward from modern cells to fossil cells and their components, their atoms, isotopes, biomolecules. What we find is that even the oldest rocks on Earth hold evidence for life that's surprisingly modern in character. The rare traces of cell-like fossils look like modern cells. The carbon isotopes and biomolecules likewise are reminiscent of cells today. All traces of life's emergent chemistry seems to have been eradicated. In fact, the major contribution from the top-down approach seems to me to be that life must have emerged in a rather narrow window, perhaps between about 4 and 3.9 billion years ago. The bottom-up approach provides a complementary and chemically more satisfying approach to studying life's origins. In Lecture 9, we saw how Stanley Miller and Harold Urey catalyzed this field with their brilliant experiment using water and simple gases in a glass tabletop experiment. They made biomolecules by mimicking a presumed prebiotic environment. In the process, they brought scientific studies of life's origins into the modern experimental age. We've learned subsequently that organic molecules must have been synthesized in abundance, and they must have accumulated in a host of prebiotic environments. Origins researchers have also demonstrated how biomolecular systems, including lipid membranes and genetic polymers, might have self-organized, or perhaps formed on mineral surfaces. Then, as molecular complexity increased, it seems plausible that primitive metabolic cycles of self-replicating molecules emerged, as did self-replicating genetic molecules. The details remain fuzzy, but much of the basic outline seems to be in place. What is certain is that the central mystery of life's origins lies in the unknown transition from a geochemical world with oceans, air, rocks, and lots of interesting organic molecules, to the evolving biochemical world in which systems of molecules self-replicate, compete, and evolve. And even if we don't know the details, it seems to me that we have to choose among three possible scenarios. The first possibility is that life began with metabolism and genetic molecules were incorporated later. This metabolism-first scenario, which is championed by Günther Wechtershäuser, Harold Morowitz, and others, states that life began autotrophically. Life's original building blocks were simple molecules like water and carbon dioxide, while minerals, perhaps in an active volcanic zone or hydrothermal vent, provided chemical energy. Life began with a self-replicating chemical cycle like the reverse citric acid cycle, perhaps on a mineral surface. Variants of this cycle competed for resources, and the system became more efficient and more complex. All subsequent chemical complexities, including genetic mechanisms and encapsulation into a cell-like structure, emerged later by the process of natural selection. In this version of life's origin, the first life emerged as an evolving chemical coating on rocks. The true predictive tests of this metabolism-first origin scenario rest on chemical synthesis experiments. Researchers have to discover a way to start a self-replicating cycle of molecules that mimics the core citric acid metabolism. We may be getting close. Several of the essential steps have been demonstrated, but there's still that key missing experiment. That's the synthesis of 4-carbon oxaloacetate from 3-carbon pyruvate. Perhaps it can be done using sulfur analogs in an environment rich in hydrogen sulfide, or maybe, as George Cody suggests, some other 3-carbon molecule like propene was used to make a useful 4-carbon molecule. If that step can be demonstrated, and if a self-sustaining cycle of reactions can be maintained, the metabolism first will be the model to beat. The second scenario is that life began with a self-replicating strand of some genetic molecule, the RNA world. According to this hypothesis, life relied on an abundance of biomolecules already present in the environment. Metabolism was incorporated later. A template like a clay mineral or a stack of paws helped to assemble information-rich polymers from organic molecules in the prebiotic soup. Ultimately, one of these polymers acquired the ability to self-replicate. Then, as variants of the genetic polymer became more efficient at self-replication, new chemical complexities arose through natural selection. In this genetic's first version, life began as an evolving polymer with a functional genetic sequence. This scenario has great appeal because of its reliance on the multiple ancient roles of RNA, a molecule that can carry information and act as a catalyst. Indeed, the genetics first model lacks only the crucial support of one experiment, an experiment that demonstrates the plausible prebiotic synthesis of a genetic polymer like RNA. If such an experiment succeeds, then the biggest gap in our understanding of life's origins will have been filled. And in that case, most experts in the field will agree that the problem of life's chemical origins has been more or less solved. And finally, there's a third scenario in which life began as a cooperative chemical phenomenon arising between metabolism and genetics. It's possible that neither a primitive metabolic cycle nor a primitive genetic molecule could have progressed far by themselves. On the one hand, metabolic molecules by themselves without enzymes tend to react in a variety of uncontrolled ways, so they may be much too unconstrained to sustain advanced cellular life. On the other hand, genetic molecules are much too unstable, and their individual building blocks, the nucleotides, don't seem to emerge spontaneously from the soup. But what if crudely self-replicating genetic molecules became attached to a crudely functioning surface-bound metabolic coating? Then a kind of cooperative chemistry might have occurred. In that event, the genetic molecules might have made use of chemical energy produced by surface metabolism to make copies of themselves. A surface metabolite might also offer a degree of protection for the delicate genetic molecules. And this system could evolve. Variations that by chance improved the chemical efficiency of the system would have been preserved preferentially. Gradually, both the genetic and metabolic components would have become more efficient and more interdependent. Such a dual origins model might seem at first to be wishy-washy. It might seem to introduce a needless complication by requiring the emergence of not one, but two chemical systems. But it may be that exactly this kind of cooperative coupling of metabolism and genetics occurred early in the history of cellular life. So, if experiments establish easy synthetic pathways to both a simple metabolic cycle and an RNA-like genetic polymer, then my guess is that such a symbiosis may represent the most likely origin scenario of all. And in this case, calling the process the origins of life, plural with an S, would make even more sense. Well, whatever the first life form was like, there must have been an unbroken chemical pathway from that early primitive state to the simplest of modern cells. The law of continuity requires that. So let's think about what must have come after the emergence of Earth's first living object. We've seen that the top-down approach provides the most important clues in this effort. We can examine two lines of evidence. First, chemical studies of cells reveal a few shared biochemical characteristics in all cells. We've seen that every cell has the deeply embedded citric acid cycle. That's the metabolic heart of life. In addition, every cell has RNA that acts as a catalyst, as well as RNA that carries genetic information. These are surely among the most ancient biochemical tricks. But every known cell also features a complex interplay between DNA, which carries genetic information, and proteins, which do most of the chemical work. In modern cells, the RNA plays what seems to be a much less prominent role. It acts sort of like a broker that converts the information of DNA into the structure of proteins. The universal and obvious conclusion, therefore, is that the RNA world was followed by the much more complex and modern, but much more efficient, DNA protein world. Now, to understand the emergence of the DNA protein world, researchers have to resort to the second type of top-down evidence. That's molecular phylogeny. Recall from Lecture 15 that molecular phylogeny involves comparing sequences of DNA or RNA and looking for similarities and differences. Any sections of the genetic message that are shared by all cells presumably represent the most ancient instructions, the information that's essential to all life. I think you can imagine how complex and time-consuming this task might be. First of all, you need to compare the genetic information of hundreds of different species. Then you need to tease out similarities that may be hidden in strings of millions or billions of genetic letters. That's a huge job. But let me give you a sense of the kind of conclusions that are now coming out. Look at this. Consider the genetic code itself. The genetic code is a set of 64 different genetic words, each one consisting of a combination of three letters, A, C, G, or T. Recall that there are two different sets of matching bases. A always matches T, C always matches G. And various combinations of three letters correspond to the 20 different amino acids that make proteins. So AAA codes for the amino acid lysine, AAC codes for the amino acid asparagine, and so forth. So here's the complete genetic code that's used by every known living organism, and it's pretty complex. Well, if you look closely at this genetic code, an intriguing pattern emerges. For combinations where the first two letters are either C or G, those first two letters apparently suffice to code some of the amino acids. There are exactly four combinations of C and G. You have CC, CG, GG, and GC. So what amino acids do they represent? It turns out that the combination GG for the first two letters always corresponds to glycine. The third letter makes no difference whatsoever. Glycine is the simplest amino acid. Its side group is just a hydrogen atom. And glycine is also the amino acid that's produced in greatest abundance by the Miller-Urey experiment. That's why a lot of researchers think glycine is the most primitive, essential amino acid, and it had to be a major part of the earliest proteins. Then, if the first two letters are GC, then it always corresponds to alanine. And alanine is the second most abundant amino acid produced in experiments. Its side group is just CH3, so alanine is also assumed to be one of the key initial amino acids. The other two combinations, CC and CG, always indicate proline and arginine, respectively. And they're also among the simpler amino acids. So look at this. We have built into the genetic code a kind of mini code of two bases and four of the simpler amino acids. And those four amino acids can combine all by themselves to form a variety of functional proteins. This situation suggests that there may have been an earlier intermediate state between the RNA world and the modern DNA protein world. Today we have four bases and 20 amino acids, but what if there was a primitive period with just two bases and four amino acids, glycine, alanine, proline, and arginine? This layered structure of the modern genetic code with a simple core and layers of increasing chemical complexity gives us good reason to believe in this transition. We go from a simpler to a more complex organization. And we also obey the principle of continuity. The modern genetic code with four letters is an elaboration of the earlier code with only two letters. And it's easy to see why the more complex code survives, because you can make much more efficient, much more sophisticated proteins with 20 amino acids. The more complex code is better, so it incorporated and replaced the simpler version long ago. Well, there are lots of other hints about the history of life that are buried in the DNA and RNA of today's cells. Many scientists are looking especially closely at the RNA that makes ribosomes, and also the transfer RNA that matches specific groups of three genetic letters to specific amino acids. This idea of layered complexity with modern biochemistry elaborating and improving on much simpler beginnings provides a great strategy for trying to understand how we got to modern life. Now, the details are way beyond the scope of this lecture, but you could consult Noam Lahav's excellent book, Biogenesis, for more information. And Christian Dedeau's book, Vital Dust, also has a good introduction to this topic. Anyway, I think you get the idea. We really do have a good chance of filling in the gaps between the RNA world and modern life. We don't yet know the answer to how life emerged, but day by day we're finding out more. New experiments expose parts of the truth, while winnowing out possibilities. whatever the correct scenario may be, we can be sure that ultimately competition began to drive natural selection. And once life emerged, it would continue to evolve to this day. For the last 23 lectures, I've been describing a systematic laboratory approach to understanding life's origins, both from the top down and from the bottom up. But it's possible that the ultimate solution to the origins question will come not from labs on Earth, but from probes of space. Think about what it would mean to discover life on another planet. Of course, the most dramatic discovery would be to make contact with an alien intelligent civilization. I think you'll all agree that such an event would radically transform our understanding of life's origins and distribution in the universe. And it's always possible that we might meet a benign, advanced alien species who could explain to us all the intricacies of life's chemical origins. Indeed, such an encounter might put a lot of scientists out of work. What seems to me a lot more likely is that we'll find convincing evidence for primitive life on another planet or moon. A lot of scientists at NASA would make a bet that we will find evidence of life on Mars if we look carefully enough. But the prevailing view is that it will be Earth-like microbial life. As I mentioned in Lecture 5, Mars was once a warm, wet planet, and it was probably habitable long before Earth. It's very possible that life in our solar system first arose on Mars. Given the significant influx of meteorites from Mars, Earth may well have been seeded with that life. If so, then any microbial life we find on Mars may be almost indistinguishable from microbes on Earth. And we can't discount the possibility that microbes from Earth may have been transferred to Mars on chunks of rock blasted into space by impacts here. The probability of an Earth to Mars transfer is much lower than Mars to Earth for two reasons. For one thing, Earth is almost 10 times more massive than Mars, so it's much harder to eject a rock from the surface. And it's vastly easier to transfer rock in towards the Sun from Mars to Earth than the other way around. In spite of these difficulties, NASA scientists are confident that life has been transferred to the surface of Mars. That's because even with the most rigorous sterilization protocols, every Mars lander and rover is loaded with microbes from Earth. Every interior surface, every crack, every pit has microbes. And unless those microbes are exposed directly to sunlight, they can survive for many years. So the Viking landers and Pathfinder and Spirit and Opportunity rovers all have brought life to Mars. Now, it's doubtful that those microbes will thrive and evolve to populate the entire planet, but we can't be sure. And it's just a fact of space exploration that there's absolutely no way that we can visit other worlds without introducing this kind of contamination. Finding Earth-like life on Mars would certainly be interesting, but I don't think such a discovery would transform our thinking. We already know that microbial life has emerged and evolved. A physical transfer of life from one planet to another would say more about the resilience of microbial life than it would about the origins of life. The real holy grail in the search for alien life is what's known in the business as second genesis. That's the discovery of a completely independent origin of life. Second genesis is an independent chemical emergence of a self-replicating, evolving system. And in our lifetimes, that discovery might happen in one of two ways. Well, actually one of three ways if you count the possibility of meeting ET. One possibility is that astronomers might find observational evidence for a living planet around a distant star. We're just now entering the age when the discovery of planets around other stars is possible. Now, most of these discoveries are made by indirect means. We can observe the periodic wobble of a star as a planet orbits around. A planet's gravity perturbs its star ever so slightly. Or we can measure the slight dimming of a star as a planet passes in front of the bright disk. These techniques are now revealing the presence of distant planets around distant stars by the hundreds, but they say nothing about whether or not the planets harbor life. But the next generation of telescopes will be designed to do much more. Plans are now in the works for ground-based telescopes with mirrors approaching the dimensions of a football field. And the next generation of space telescopes, if NASA can get the necessary funding, will also be much larger than the Hubble Space Telescope. The idea is that these giant instruments will allow us to actually image Earth-like planets orbiting nearby stars. Using spectroscopy, we'll be able to see the planet's color and measure the distinctive absorption lines from the planet's atmosphere. And if we find a planet with an oxygen-rich atmosphere like ours, then we'll have discovered compelling evidence for a second genesis. But there's another way that we might discover a second genesis. It's possible that we will recover actual samples of a completely alien form of life from Mars, or Europa, or some other body in our own solar system. The first Mars sample return mission might take place as early as 2013. Who knows what secrets a shovel full of Martian soil might hold? So how would we know if a Martian microbe represents a second genesis? It's very likely that alien cells would be small, round, or elongate objects, and rather nondescript, so they'd look a lot like Earth life. Biochemistry would be the key. Any organism that emerged with an independent origin process will display a different biochemistry. To take the most extreme view, it's possible that alien life will possess radically different chemistry with a totally different complement of metabolic and genetic molecules. In that case, we'll know the life is alien pretty quickly. But even if we find that the citric acid cycle, lipid membranes, and RNA are inevitable aspects of life everywhere in the universe, some of the chemical details will certainly be different. For example, all life forms will likely use the commonest amino acids like glycine, alanine, and proline. But a second genesis will surely employ a suite of amino acids that's different from the idiosyncratic set of 20 that cells on Earth use. And the details of the genetic code, exactly which genetic letters specify which amino acids, will also be different for a second genesis. Those are details that biochemists can sort out rather easily. If we find hard evidence of a second genesis, then we'll have a gold mine of biological data. On the one hand, a second, entirely independent origin of life will reveal countless details about life's inevitable origin and its shared chemical characteristics. Is the citric acid cycle an essential metabolic first step? Is RNA the universal genetic molecule? On the other hand, we'll also discover some of the chance chemical choices and quirks of our own biochemistry. Which amino acids are optional? What other polycyclic molecules besides sterols might play a role in alien life? If we find physical evidence of a second genesis in our own solar system, then suddenly Earth biology will become just one example of what must be countless billions of independent origins of life throughout space and time. A central theme of this lecture series has been the remarkable power of emergence to drive increases in the complexity of natural systems. The theory of emergence argues for an inexorable evolution of the cosmos, from atoms to stars to planets to life. Each emergent step arises from interactions among countless agents. Each emergent event produces an outcome that's much greater than the sum of its parts. Each emergent process is reasonable and sequential, and each step increases the degree of order and complexity. It all makes sense. But the fact is that we can recognize this majestic progression only in hindsight. Emergent phenomena are all but impossible to predict from observations of earlier stages. Given hydrogen atoms, for example, it would require an extraordinary conceptual leap to predict the behavior of stars or the variety of planets. Then given a planet, no theoretician could predict the emergence of cellular life. And by the same token, given a collection of cells, no one could extrapolate to the emergence of consciousness and self-awareness. In every case, the inherent novelty and layered complexity of emergent phenomena seem impossible to predict. And so, I want to leave you with one closing thought about the emergence and evolution of life. Are we it? Is human intelligence the highest possible emergent state? Or is it possible that there might be higher orders of emergence. If so, then it's also possible that our individual brains can no more comprehend such a state than a single neuron can comprehend consciousness. Perhaps the universe holds levels of emergence beyond individual consciousness and beyond even the collective accomplishments of human societies. If that's true, then the story of life's origins and evolution is far from over. Indeed, perhaps the story has only begun.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online. Visit our website at www.teachone2.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-1-2. That's 1-800-TEACH-1-2. Thank you very much.